You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 12th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio.
France's parliament prepares to vote oui on the president's plans for supporting Ukraine, the uses of humour amid existential national struggle, and one of South Korea's resident panda diplomats is recalled to base. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Vincent McAvenny and Olga Tokariuk will discuss the day's big stories, and we'll meet the agency promoting Australia's Indigenous art and artists to the world. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Vincent McAvenny, journalist and Monocle Radio regular politics commentator, and by Olga Tokariuk, a Ukrainian journalist and also a regular voice here on Monocle. And Olga, hopefully an even more regular voice on Monocle Radio, because you've moved here. You now live among us.
Yeah, I've moved to London and still trying to come to terms with it.
Which bits of it are you trying to come to terms with? I mean, I've been here for 35 years and I feel like I'm getting there.
Well, I lived in a big city in Ukraine, but that feels like a lifetime ago, you know. And since then, since I moved to the UK in September 2022, I was based in Oxford with all the perks of being in a small town, but very vibrant, very diverse. So returning to a megapolis feels a bit shocking, to be frank.
You'll get kind of used to it. What will you be doing in London other than appearing hopefully more often on the Monocle Daily?
So I'm now with Chatham House. I'm a fellow at Ukraine Forum doing research on Ukraine, on Ukrainian refugees, on how to encourage their return and can they contribute to Ukraine's reconstruction while they are temporarily away.
Okay. And Vincent, last time you were in one of these seats, you explained that you were about to go skiing. You are now even more about to go skiing.
Yeah, the sound effects are packed.
It's like a little advent calendar for us.
It is, although it's been the same thing, and I am going to do something about this whilst I'm away from Monocle. The season seems to have been pretty mixed for European ski resorts, and I think it is one of the clearer signs of climate change and the effects it will have on the continent, not just in terms of the clear sort of, you know, weather effects that we can all see, but also on huge industries that are built up in remote parts of countries like Italy, Austria, France, which, you know, all year round they are supported by having ski season and tourism, and those are now in jeopardy because the weather and the season is completely mixed. It's hard to predict, and that's something that I'll be looking into. But I've got to say, as someone who's lived in London 14 years-ish now, I think my best advice for coming here: ignore the tube map because it distorts completely your view of where everything is in London. Take the bus and sit on the top at the front, London double-decker bus, and you'll piece together London so much quicker because the tube map completely distorts the dimensions and the proportions and what's next to what. So I'd say as much as you can, take the bus and sit at the top.
And also you can pretend you're driving. But do remember, on entering a London Underground carriage, it is customary to shake hands with every other passenger. Olga and Vincent, we will have more from you both shortly, but first to the United States, where Congress has been hearing the testimony of Robert Hur, the special counsel who investigated the mishandling of classified documents by President Joe Biden. Hur's report concluded that while Biden's conduct in this matter was suboptimal, it did not rise to the threshold of criminality. More controversial when the report was released was Hur's editorializing about the state of Biden's memory, which more than one flint-hearted skeptic has suggested had more to do with Hur's hopes of securing a top job in the event of the re-election of his former patron, Donald Trump. Well, I'm joined now by Thomas Gift, an associate professor of political science and director of the Centre on US Politics at University College London. Thomas, as we were just explaining there, Robert Hur's report did not find that Biden had done anything especially criminal, but nor did it entirely exonerate him. So did he get roughed up by both sides today?
Well, I think that you're absolutely right, and thanks so much for having me. I think that it is important to emphasize that Robert Hur did not exonerate Joe Biden, and largely his rationale for not charging him was twofold. One is the longstanding norm of the Department of Justice of not indicting a sitting president. But more so, he said that essentially he didn't feel like a jury would be willing to convict Biden for what he had done, in large part because he was described as, quote, a sympathetic, well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory. And so as a result, would kind of be viewed with a lot of empathy. So, you know, I think from that standpoint, it certainly ruffled a lot of feathers among Democrats. But the fact that he didn't go further also angered some Republicans. So I think he certainly did enough to create discontent among both partisan sides.
I mean, the Democrats today were rather gleefully making use of this opportunity to show clips of President Trump forgetting, well, details of what he was talking about, how the sentence he was currently uttering had actually started, and generally short-circuiting. And there is not any shortage of material of that kind. But at this point, does any of that stuff register with voters, or has everybody basically already made their minds up, do we think?
Well, I really think that a lot of voters have made their minds up for a couple of reasons. One is just we have two presidential candidates who are essentially running as de facto incumbents. They're very known quantities. They're so different and they're so alienating for a sizable portion of the American electorate that it's almost hard to imagine being sort of an on the fence or swing voter at this point. And also just the narratives around both candidates have become very clear. For Donald Trump, the Achilles heel, at least potentially in a general election, is the 91 criminal indictments. And for Joe Biden, rightly or wrongly, it's about these concerns regarding his mental acuity. And I think you're absolutely right. You can point to all sorts of examples where Donald Trump mixes up names, says outlandish things, makes unhinged comments. But there's just this perception among the American electorate that's very difficult to shake, that Joe Biden is sort of more frail. He's less robust. I think he did do a lot to diffuse some of that criticism at the State of the Union. But still, this is a weight that's going to continue to be around his neck for the rest of the campaign.
Nevertheless, and for reasons you've just been explaining, this may not be the point anyway, are Republicans actually going to be able to make the document stuff stick to Biden? Because as the report says, Biden clearly was in breach of the rules. He clearly did things with some documents that he should not have done with those documents. But he can at least say that he didn't stack crates and crates and crates of them in various bathrooms and ballrooms of his golf club.
No, absolutely. And I don't think that Republicans want to get into a game of comparison, because there's no doubt about it that what Donald Trump did was much more egregious than what Joe Biden did. And particularly with regards to the obstruction and the unwillingness to work with federal prosecutors and investigators once these documents had been identified. You know, Joe Biden did hand them over immediately, cooperated with prosecutors. It was the exact opposite with Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago. So, you know, Donald Trump is going to try to muddy the waters here and say that he's sort of been unfairly singled out for prosecution because of political reasons. And this is part of his larger narrative as being a victim of a partisan witch hunt. But, you know, I do think that this issue is going to kind of fade into the backdrop of all the other, you know, policy issues and just personality differences between the two candidates as we head into November.
Thomas Gift at UCL, thank you for joining us. You are listening to The Daily. We can go back now to our panelists, Vincent McAvenny and Olga Tokariuk. And in recent weeks, President Emmanuel Macron of France has once again attempted to position himself in the vanguard of Ukraine's European allies, even occasioning an amount of continental uproar by suggesting that it was not impossible that the troops of NATO nations might eventually have to be deployed. By way of demonstrating France's resolve, the National Assembly in Paris is due to vote shortly on a symbolic resolution in support of Macron's Ukraine strategy. And while this is occurring, US President Joe Biden is hosting at the White House Poland's President Andrzej Duda and Prime Minister Donald Tusk, two men who don't agree on much but have been by and large supportive of Ukraine. First of all, Olga, as somebody from the country on the receiving end of well, obviously Russia's attack and Europe's continuing bewilderment as to how it's supposed to respond. How does it seem to you, and we are now slightly over 2 years since Russia launched its full-scale assault on Ukraine, does it seem to you that Europe has yet entirely grasped what it is up against?
No, I don't think so. I think there is still a lack of sense of urgency in Europe. They understand that they have to step in and they have to step up their support for Ukraine, especially now that there is a lot of concern over the U.S. elections, over the lacking package of military aid that the U.S. Congress is unable to pass already for months. So Europeans understand that they need to be more independent, that they need to rely on themselves, but they still did not develop the capacity to do that. So Macron's initiative, in a way, gives us... it is a sign that Europeans are increasingly concerned that they might be left on their own, and there is a search for a leader, and Macron saw this opportunity to present himself as a European leader who is coming up with an unpopular idea at the moment. But I think what he said when he mentioned that he does not exclude that troops of Western countries could be sent to Ukraine, I think why he said it and what he meant to do is to kind of, yes, test the reaction, and also to kind of signal that nothing should be taken off the table, because we see that the previous strategy of just telling Russians what the West will not do, we will not do that, we will not supply these kind of weapons,
thing that has gone on for 2 years.
Yeah, attacks on Russian territory. Yeah,
the West saying we won't do this, and then 3 weeks later, all right, we'll do it.
Exactly, and it's just not working, it's just emboldening Russia. So what Macron is doing, he's trying to change that strategy and to test also how many allies he can have by like floating this idea of having Western troops on Ukrainian territory. Although Ukrainian President Zelensky said Ukraine is not asking for troops of other countries to be deployed, that Ukraine is able to fight on its own, it just needs more weapons.
I mean, Vincent, do you get a sense that, well, as Olga suggests, there is an attempt from at least some quarters in Europe to get people to think about at least the idea that this may end up having to go further than mere equipment being sent to Ukraine? Because Macron, it's definitely a minority view at the moment, but he's not entirely on his own. Poland's recently reinstalled Foreign Minister Radek Sikorski said last week, well, he said that NATO troops were already in Ukraine, by which one assumes he means special forces of a few nations which have been coordinating.
Something which Germany kindly confirmed seemingly recently.
But Sikorski also said that nothing should be ruled out. Now, for obvious reasons, Poland has taken this a lot more seriously than countries further west. No one needs to tell any of our Polish listeners about the threat that Russia can pose when on the march. But can you see this idea gathering momentum?
Well, I mean, firstly, it is strategic ambiguity. Mm. We shouldn't take anything off the table because, you know, the point of this fog of war is that you can't fully anticipate what the other side will do, and you have to leave it as an option on the table. Clearly, there would be reluctance in European countries to deploy. There would be fears about escalation. But it sort of depends which way the war is going to go. If it does feel that there's a turning point where, you know, Russia starts to again sort of have huge losses on the field, and people think that perhaps, you know, sending troops might be the right way to sort of finish this once and for all, to sort of support and defend Ukraine, then you could see that being a card that Europe wants to have in its back pocket, and why cancel that option out? But I mean, what is interesting about Macron is, I think, you know, when Angela Merkel stepped off the stage, he was trying to become the sort of main man of Europe, the real leader of Europe. And in a lot of ways, he's had a help that Olaf Scholz is clearly having a very difficult time in Germany. He hasn't had a good chancellorship. But I think what we sort of forgot with Merkel was that she's sort of benefited sometimes in her leadership of Europe in that Smurfette syndrome. She was often the only woman in a room full of male leaders, or, you know, at the table or at Brussels or whatever, or it was just, you know, she was one of two. And so she naturally stood out and people were more interested in her and what she said. With Macron, he hasn't had that kind of boost. He hasn't emerged so much to the fore. We know that he obviously won't be running for another term. He's got a few more years left to go. So he doesn't, he's sort of free in some ways to be more direct than a lot of other European leaders are when it comes to Ukraine and pushing forward. But we can see from this vote that's taking place in Paris that there is still a bit of malaise and I think a failure of imagination amongst European peoples about the dangers that they're in the sort of west of Europe versus the east of Europe, but also, you know, Nordic countries. We have to step back and think, you know, the addition of Finland and particularly Sweden, 200 years of neutrality overturned because they are border countries with Russia and they have had skirmishes with them in the past. And they know it's important, you know, in the way that their civil society is structured, you know, the sort of permanent defence and that they all have to be ready to and trained in certain things. That's something that Western Europe, even though there is in living memory in France, the memory of an invasion and occupation, that we seem to be really... Obviously, we don't want to think about it. There's a reluctance to even imagine it, but we have to start imagining that this is no longer taken for granted, that, you know, Europe can remain intact and as free as it has been.
Olga, just finally on this one, and we should also note a couple of other, well, there's a recent development in the United States. The White House in particular has, it thinks it's found a way to send another $300 million worth of weapons to Ukraine, despite the gridlock in Congress. But you know, as you know, and you will have heard, and you've doubtless said a few times over the last couple of years, there is still this thing, or is there, that Ukraine feels like it is being given enough to survive, but not enough to actually win. And while I think it is clear that Ukraine's allies, it seems to me at least often that they're caught between, they want Ukraine to win, but they can't quite accept the fact that that will by definition means that Russia loses. And that is likely to open up a whole other hideous can of worms. Does it feel like that to you as well?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I think most Ukrainians feel that now maybe they are not even given enough to survive because we see Ukraine lost some territory in recent weeks and Russians are pushing in several directions. And in general, you know, this kind of indecisiveness and lack of action on behalf of the Western countries, it just emboldens Russia to be more aggressive, to push more. And Russia basically switched its economy to a wartime mode, which is something that the Western countries haven't done and are reluctant to do. Even, you know, increasing their defense spending to 2% of GDP is a problem for many countries. So, yes, Ukrainians see it that it still hasn't occurred to many of countries that rhetorically support Ukraine or support Ukraine, you know, with at press conferences with nice words, but they do not do enough in practice to demonstrate that support. And they also kind of fail to realize how precious every moment, every minute and every day is.
Well, sticking with Ukraine, it does seem likely that among the many miscalculations made by President Vladimir Putin of Russia 2 years ago was one regarding the metal of his opposite number in Kyiv. Prior to entering politics, President Volodymyr Zelensky was a comedian, a member of a popular satirical troupe, a sitcom actor, and the Ukrainian voice of Paddington Bear. But while Putin, like all tyrants, is entirely without humour, Zelensky has wielded wit as a weapon in his nation's defence. And he's not the first.
We develop strong security guarantees for our country and for entire Europe and the world together with you. And also together with you, we'll put in place everyone who will defy freedom. Put in.
Really, a possibility to see my children and my dogs. Sometimes I'm thinking, really, looking at all these wars, not only Ukraine, everywhere, in Africa, in the Middle East, sometimes I'm looking at this and think that the best way, if this planet will be the planet of dogs. I don't understand. Sometimes I don't understand people, really. I can't understand. I think that they are just crazy, crazy people.
I cannot help but reflecting that if my father had been American and my mother British, instead of the other way around, I might have got here on my own.
That last clip, of course, being the British voice in least need of back announcement. If I've called that correctly, that was Winston Churchill addressing the US Congress. Before that, President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine. Vincent, I wanted to ask you first, as one of the two token non-Ukrainians at this table, observing this conflict over the last couple of years and observing the Ukrainian response to it, I don't know how much of an expert you were more than 2 years ago in the Ukrainian sense of humour, but what have you learned about it in that time?
I mean, I think it's very similar to British sense of humour. I think it is quite dry, and there is a lot of gallows humour sometimes, and humour is an act of defiance. I mean, listening to Zelensky there, he's had a few good lines over the years. I do think he made a misstep, though, because I think if the world was run by dogs, we'd very quickly be in a war with all squirrels across all nations, if you've ever seen the attacks in the park. But no, I think we have learned that, you know, Ukrainians have a great sense of humour. I think back to the early part of the war with the radio comms that came out of the Ukrainian base that was at a lighthouse island, I believe, and how defiant they were and funny they were towards, you know, their Russian attackers. And I think that endeared them. I think, you know, Britain's had the experience, and again, you know, as in living memory, as I said, France earlier, with having an occupation, of being a country that's being bombarded, of having to have some kind of hope and have some humour to get you through that. And that's something that Britain adopted. And it's also been used subsequently, thinking about things like a lower low and Dad's Army, to deal with the trauma of the experience afterwards as well, is quite helpful. So I think it's really shown that, you know, Ukrainian and British sense of humours are quite aligned in, you know, in mocking it. And I think there is also the thing as well with all dictators is that they are so bloody camp, and they are pantomime and they are theatrical. And the best thing you can do is make fun of that, you know, in the great tradition of, you know, Charlie Chaplin with The Dictator, is to just make fun of this insane apparatus that they build around them, and you know, how kind of grand they become, and the silly costumes they wear. And the only thing you can do at that when their own people are crippled by it is to point and laugh at it and show how stupid it is.
Olga, you've written about this, I know, the use of humour in Ukraine's war for its own survival. And obviously it is a coping mechanism. I've not visited Ukraine since this conflict started, but I have covered several others. And in all of the conflicts I've covered, the people who are fighting them or the people who are caught up in them always find a way to laugh at them as well. It's often pretty bleak, and the humour is quite a lot of the time not something I would be happy to repeat on a family broadcast such as this. But it is clearly important. But I did want to ask about whether you think humour has been an actual weapon for Ukraine. And we've seen it a lot, not just with Ukraine supporters on social media, but official Ukraine channels on social media, including the actual Ukraine Twitter account, which has been teasing, baiting and trolling Russia since this thing started.
Yeah, well, actually, Ukraine Twitter account was founded even before the full-scale invasion. So this war in the information space using jokes and memes has been going on for years already, and Ukraine has been winning it. And in terms of, you know, President Zelensky's, you played some jokes that he made, but my favorite one is when he was asked at a press conference by a journalist what Ukraine would be ready to, you know, what concessions Ukraine would be ready to make in order to to have peace. And he said, well, we are ready to give up on Belgorod, which is actually part of Russia. It's on the border with Ukraine. So he said, we are ready to give up Belgorod. These are territories that we are ready to give up. It's just an insider joke. Not everybody understood it, but it was like really popular in Ukraine at the time. And it really kind of, not only this is a joke, it's also an answer to a question that is really very frustrating, very annoying. It's an answer to all those calls on Ukraine to make concessions, recently repeated by Pope Francis. So something that a lot of Ukrainians feel a lot of anger and frustration over, this pressure on Ukraine to make concessions when it is clearly not in Ukraine's hands to end this war. It is in Russia's hands. But coming back to your question about the, you know, the use of humor, I think the remarkable what is remarkable about Ukrainians' use of it is that it is very much a bottom-up process. So it is not something that the government told people to do, or even though the government in its social media accounts uses humor and jokes and memes, but this is something that a lot of citizens started to do. It was very organic in the very first days of the full-scale invasion, with the worship response that Vincent mentioned, with, you know, the meme about based on a real situation in south of Ukraine, when a lady told a Russian soldier, just put some sunflower seeds in your pocket, so when you, you know, are killed here, at least something good will grow out of you. So there were real situation that later became memes, and they became the symbols of Ukrainian resistance, of Ukrainian courage, of Ukrainian defiance. And then, of course, the humor has been a psychologically very important mechanism to help Ukrainians cope. A lot of gallows humor, a lot of jokes that, yeah, you maybe would not want your children to hear. And of course, ridiculing and exposing Russian propaganda and disinformation. This is something that the humor really helped with, because it is not just enough to say, well, this is not true, they are lying, or here is the truth. A lot of audience will just not get that information. But if you ridicule what they are saying, if you ridicule the way Russians are trying to portray Ukrainians as, not a separate people, as just confused Russians, or Ukrainian culture as something that is artificial, or Ukrainian state as something that doesn't have a right to exist. And responding to that with humor really helps, because that's what Russians are incapable of. And people immediately see the difference between the way Ukrainians communicate and Russians communicate, and they think, no, these two can't be the same people.
It may be an illustration of Vincent's point about the overlap between the Ukrainian and the British sense of humour, but I do recall at one point a well-known far-right talk radio bloviator in this country, who in fairness was taking Ukraine's side, but rhetorically harumphed, well, which part of the United Kingdom would people be happy to give up to Russia? She was absolutely deluged with helpful answers on social media by British people. Croydon came up quite a lot, as I recall. But to South Korea now, where an amount of garment rending is reported at the imminent departure of a panda. Fu Bao is the first South Korean-born panda. She is the offspring of parents Ai Bao and Lei Bao, emissaries dispatched by China in 2016 as part of the People's Republic's panda diplomacy outreach, and is now returning home. However, South Korean aficionados of roly-poly black and white bamboo scoffers need not panic. Fu Bao's parents are staying, along with their more recent twins, Rui Bao and Hui Bao. First of all, Olga, have you in fact ever stood in a queue to see a panda?
I didn't stand in a queue, but I did see panda. Yeah, that happened in...
Where are you seeing pandas where you don't even have to queue? I saw them in Sydney years ago. The queue was halfway across New South Wales. And when I got to the end of it, they didn't do anything.
That was in Beijing many years ago, in Beijing Zoo. And after that, I still actually sometimes have nightmares about getting lost in Beijing and, not seeing any English, any signs in English, and not meeting any person who knows, who speaks English.
I'm sensing that big city anxiety is quite a thing with you.
Oh, yeah.
Vincent, have you ever seen pandas?
I have seen two. I saw Mei Zhang and Chan Chan, who are at the National Zoo in Washington, D.C. back in 2008. Same as you, bit of queuing, and they didn't really do much. I have a very close friend there who has a fantastic panda story.
Go
which
on.
Was she spent 20 hours on a bus whilst teaching in China to visit a town where she knew that there were pandas in the zoo because she wanted to see one. She arrived to be told that sadly the panda had indeed passed away that day, but she could still have a photo with it.
No!
To which... everything happened so quickly that she sort of stood next to the panda, and then the trainer put her hand on the dead panda and said, smile, and snapped a photo. And so that's one of her great gap year memories. It's just her trying to smile with a dead panda. Wow. Weekend at Bernie's style.
I know, that's the best gap year memory literally anybody has ever had, though.
Exactly. I do say to her, though, it's no different to seeing them when they're alive. They just don't do anything.
Well, that was certainly my experience. But what I wanted to ask you both, and I'll ask you first, Olga, because I'm not against the panda. I'm broadly pro-panda. I'm just a bit sceptical about the whole concept of panda diplomacy, because as you gazed upon the panda, did it actually improve your view of the People's Republic of China?
Well, I didn't think about that in those terms at the time, but my encounter with panda was more positive. The panda was swinging.
Well, it was alive, so it, there
it was,
was
swinging,
that.
And at some at some point, it just fell out of swing, and it was really funny. So that happened some time ago. It was in 2008, I didn't have an opinion on People's Republic of China back then, I'm afraid.
Okay.
But I don't think seeing panda would have improved my opinion if I had it at the time.
Vincent, did it do anything for you? Because, did you go in there perhaps thinking that China is, for all its impressive economic accomplishments of recent decades, a somewhat grim totalitarian autocracy, and then walk away from the pandas thinking, actually, you know what, on mature reflection, I think they're a great bunch of lads?
Not really. And I do think, actually, I mean, if you're going to have any kind of diplomacy, I think cultural diplomacy, and in particular music diplomacy, is the most important thing you can do. If you think back to the Cold War, you know, the fact that the Beatles from this country were hugely popular in Russia, other bands, you know, made their way into Russia as well over the years, particularly kind of, you know, the big rock bands, the big rock bands of the 1980s as well, they got played in Russia, and there was a thirst to hear that music. And, you know, many Western artists are popular in China, but I can't think of many Chinese artists who are popular around the world. You know, there are classical musicians and such, but, you know, that's been a talent that the South Koreans have copped onto in the last 15 years. The explosion in K-pop, I'd say, has done a lot more for building global interest in South Korean culture and an affinity towards South Korea than a few pandas in zoos, which you actually have to travel to see and then are, as we've all agreed, quite disappointing.
Well, in closing, I did want to ask you each in turn, and I will start with you, Olga. And the game we're playing here is that you have to choose an animal that would best represent your country abroad, and it has to be an animal that actually comes from the country. I know as an Australian, we have a wealth of options, and Australia has of late been trying to do what is called koala diplomacy. We have sent koalas overseas to try and impress people. The koala, for any listeners thinking of standing in a queue to see a koala, is basically the same deal as the panda, except it's slightly smaller and it does nothing sitting further up trees. Seriously, don't stand in line to see one. But what Ukrainian...
There's a very famous story about what a recently passed away Australian minister and koalas.
John Brown is very much still with us. Was recently interviewed by Godwin for Monocle Radio.
Yes, he was recently on Monocle Radio, not passed away. That's why I knew the story, yeah.
But which Ukrainian animal do you think could act in the world as a diplomat for Ukraine?
Oh, wow. That's a tough question.
It doesn't really have to do anything. We've established that pandas just sort of sit there, so it doesn't need to be that active.
I only can think of animals in terms of cuisine for some reason. I don't know why. Maybe because I haven't had my dinner yet. But I'm thinking we in Ukraine are big fans of bacon, of lard. So if we, you know, represent Ukraine through cultural diplomacy, then maybe a pig?
Okay.
Why not?
Okay. And it's going to be even more confusing and difficult for you, Vincent, because I'm confining you to Jersey. I don't even know if you've got an option.
Well, I mean, we already have a captive troop of animals that we send around the world. They're called the royal family. They live in a gilded cage. They're snapped photos relentlessly. We poke at them and they, you know, can't do anything much back. In terms of Jersey, I mean, we have dolphins. So,
that's pretty cool.
That's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. So they are pretty nice. I'd go for that.
Okay. Well, on that upbeat note, Vincent McAvaney and Olga Tokariuk, thank you both. And finally, on today's show, Australian Indigenous art is booming, with buyers and galleries at home and abroad more excited than ever by works by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander artists. 2023 saw the Australian state of Victoria welcome its first art market specialising in First Nations artists, while the genre has been picked up by Sotheby's for dedicated auctions. This growing visibility of Indigenous art and artists is due in part to organisations like Agency Project, a not-for-profit that promotes Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander art, culture and people, founded in collaboration with community leaders. Its co-founder, Cade MacDonald, and his team show Indigenous artworks in North America, Europe and Asia, and work with Australia's government to promote their artists. Monocle's Lillian Fawcett caught up with Cade, as well as Agency's public programmes manager, Leila Guruwiwi, at Singapore's biggest contemporary art fair, ArtSG. Lillian began by asking Cade why he founded Agency Project.
There certainly was always, and has been for a long time, a strong interest in First Nations art, and it's been growing and it's been promoted really well. Globally, that has shifted again, especially in North America. There's a huge surge of interest. The timing for us was kind of right. There was a gap that was identified, and that gap was identified by those community leaders that we'd worked with, who knew that we could steward relationships and find those opportunities that, for the most part, could be really difficult for those people in remote locations to do. But also, that was the remit and the purpose of Agency, was to really steward those kind of opportunities. So we've seen a huge growth. ArtSG, having a relationship through the Art Assembly and Sydney Contemporary Art Fair in Australia, they've witnessed that growth as well. When you go to Sydney Contemporary, and there's so much First Nations work in those galleries in Australia now, and so that's growing internationally as well. So the timing was right, but the gap was identified by those leaders.
And Leila, where is that interest mostly coming from in terms of particular regions, and what do you think is really driving it now internationally?
Well, it's a known fact that Aboriginal art is one of the biggest exports outside of Australia, like First Nations art. So there's a big audience internationally that are interested in First Nations art, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander art. And I think with agency, we have the opportunity to challenge people's perspectives on what First Nation art is. You know, once upon a time it was quite traditional, and now even looking at the pieces that we have here at the booth, there are quite contemporary pieces that people, you know, at first glance may not know is First Nations, because there's been a narrative, a construct that was created of what First Nations people were, what Aboriginal people were, and now we're shifting and moving away from that. You know, traditional art still has a place, ceremonial art still has a place, especially in lots of communities that are still currently practicing. But, you know, you have some amazing people who are on their own kind of cultural journey that are trying to understand their own identity, because, so of course, their art's going to look very different to someone who's grounded in their cultural identity. So giving opportunities to lots of different voices is really important.
And Cade, what particular art markets are you targeting and trying to kind of penetrate at the moment with Aboriginal art?
Certainly there's been waves historically of interest that's come out of Europe, and perhaps a peak at the moment is definitely in North America. We saw some really strong activity in the secondary market there through some of the auction houses, and that has then driven the primary market. And so we're actually going to the US next Friday, where we will launch the third iteration of a touring exhibition that we've had touring America for the last 3 years. And then we go to New York for a big commercial exhibition at a very reputable gallerist in New York of a series of works from First Nations artists across Australia. So our role is really the broader advocacy. And so we do a lot of work with the federal government, the Department of Foreign Affairs, a lot of the posts that are around the world. We've done huge projects in Mexico, Shanghai, Italy. By consolidating all that interest and feeding into that interest, we are creating a broad international foundation for the growth in the markets.
Should we have a look at one of the pieces that you have on display here a bit more closely? Leila, maybe you can talk me through it.
So this is Barawa Monongo's artwork, and I'm actually connected to this artwork. I am related to the artist through our kinship system in Northeast Arnhem Land, and this particular artwork talks to the connection between Yolngu and Makassan people of the Sulawesi region of Indonesia a couple of hundred years prior to colonisation. We actually traded with the Makassans. So we traded things like galiko, cloth. We traded steel, machetes, tobacco, and it's all kind of embedded itself into our Yolngu culture and language. And this work talks to the song lines. So song lines are lines on country, as well as these ones are across the ocean. So it connects us to the Makassans and vice versa as well. And it's quite iridescent because the artwork is done on the backside of road signs. So if you actually flip them over, you'll see a stop sign on the back. And traditionally, these designs would be done with ochre, but this artist actually had a discussion with some of the elders and said that they should be able to use these because they are actually a part of country through the embedding of those steel poles into place. And this is quite a contemporary way of showing Yolngu design as well.
That was Leila Guruwiwi and earlier Cade MacDonald speaking to Monocle's Lillian Fawcett. And that is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. Thanks to our guests today, Thomas Gift, Olga Tokariuk and Vincent McAvaney. Today's show was produced by Emma Searle and researched by George Ruskin. Our sound engineer was Lily Austin. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.